Hello, everyone, and welcome to the FamVestor Podcast. I'm your host, Sunny Burns.
And I'm your co-host, Sunmarie Burns.
Today on the podcast, we have Megan Murata Russell. She's the Chief Operating Officer of Murata Wealth Management, and she's young. She's only 30 years old and still so knowledgeable. So when I was looking into funding my kids' Roth IRA, I stumbled upon her articles because they're so in-depth, so detailed, and I really truly appreciated that, so I wanted to get her on the show.
There's a lot of fluffy stuff out there that doesn't give you much information and wastes your time when you're trying to read it. So when you read her articles, you found that really they gave you a sense of direction and what to do with funding a Roth IRA.
And it wasn't like, it depends and blah, blah, blah. So we go into her story on the podcast for her funding her three-year-old's Roth IRA. We talk about 529s, the difference between the two, and what which one might be better for your family. Mm-hmm. So definitely an episode to listen to. We do go into the weeds a little bit, but I think it's of value to a lot of people because there's a lot of questions surrounding that. So just truly a very knowledgeable person, you know, has read many publications that have been republished, and she's been quoted in many different media coverages around the country. So definitely an authority in this space, and something that I think, just really easy to talk to too. So it was just a very pleasant conversation. We learned a bunch,
right?
And it was just a fun talk. So I hope you guys gained some insight from this conversation. And without further ado, let's get to the show.
You're listening to the FamVestor Podcast. If you're looking to raise your family with intention, gain financial independence, and live a life of true freedom, you're in the right place. Join us as we explore together how to create thriving families, because strong families are the cornerstone for a world at peace.
Megan, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. You know, we were really trying to get you on here, and we just kept coordinating through the months, and finally we got you, so I'm so excited. So I'm just going to start out, you know, with our audience, who don't know you so well. In regards to family, finance, and freedom, and the life you now lead, where does your origin story begin?
Well, I have kind of a funny answer to that. I think my origin story really begins on the Barbie aisle. Barbie. Because when I was a kid, I used to do just all sorts of odds and ends jobs around the house. And for my neighbors, I earned all sorts of random, you know, $5 here, $10 there. And once a week, we used to just go to Toys R Us for fun as a family. It kind of seems out of character for my family since we don't spend a ton. But we used to just go and like browse around and play with what toys we could play with in the aisles. And I remember one day I was standing on the Barbie aisle with my dad, and he went, "Do you realize, Megan, that you can afford anything you want on this aisle?" And I looked around and I thought, "Are you kidding me? Anything?" Looked up. I was like, "I can buy the dream house up there." It was like $100. I had $150 in my sock, you know? And then I just remember the freedom that was experienced there. Like, wait, okay, so I could buy that. But for the same price, I could buy 15 Barbies. You know? It's just like, wow, this is crazy. And so really, like, that was the eye-opening moment for me that just brought, like, a love of finance and financial planning and just the experience. I hope that everybody gets to experience that one day. The I could buy anything here. And you know what's funny? I left that aisle and I didn't buy anything.
Nice.
So it was just really, really quite the experience.
Wow. Sounds like a transformative moment in your childhood. And speaking about that, my family used to take me to Toys R Us, too, just to look around the aisles and peruse. We never bought anything. I can't remember a single time buying something at Toys R Us, but we had a lot of fun walking through the store.
Yes. It's the cheapest entertainment because you can play with all the toys and then you can go home.
Right.
So I'm guessing you grew up pretty frugal then. You said your family didn't like to spend a lot of money.
Yes, I I just came out a miser. Like, okay. I'm just a miserly, frugal personality. And, you know, so my brother isn't. Like, he liked spending money. He's good at, you know, managing it, living within his means. But I'm definitely the miser of the family. I've come to terms with the fact that one of my financial goals is being able to have enough money that if a problem comes along that can be solved by money, I can solve it. And that's just one of my goals in life. I want to, if a problem, like when the roof gets a hole in it, I don't want to wonder how I'm going to solve the problem. I just want to solve it. And so having money on the side is actually one of my goals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Awesome. Yeah, no, that just brings to mind, like, and I guess I was talking to a family member recently, and he's like, yeah, I really want this Tesla, and it's so awesome, and he's like, you can afford a Tesla, why don't you just buy a Tesla? And I'm just like, I don't want a Tesla. I have my Toyota Yaris that gets 40 miles per gallon, zero maintenance, has roll-up windows, so I don't have to maintain that either, and it's awesome.
A fraction of the cost.
And just like, and I feel like your point about, like, when you have enough to buy it, you know, and you know that you could have it if you want it, then it's not as, I don't know, it's not as tantalizing anymore, because it is within your grasp, but you realize that it's just a want that you don't really actually even want, you know, it's definitely not a need.
It's also harder for parents who have extra money, because when you don't have a lot of extra money, you always have the excuse, we can't afford it. It's not in the budget. But when you have extra money, that's not an excuse you can use anymore with your kids, or, you know, at least not one that works very well. And so instead, you have to have much harder conversations, like, it's not worth it. That's not worth the money, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't want to buy that cheap plastic thing that's cost $20. It's just not worth it. Or, like, it sounds like it's worth it to you, but it's not worth it to me. Mm-hmm. So, like, you need to save up your money so you can buy that. And those kinds of conversations are just so much harder to have, you know?
Yes.
Whereas if you could just say, we can't afford it, you know, they don't learn as much, but it is, you know, honest to that family situation.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's exactly why I wanted you on the show. You know, when I started researching about Roth IRAs and paying your kids, so many of your articles were so descriptive and informative, not generic like so many other articles. You went right to the point and went very factual and very detailed, which I loved all your articles that way. I feel like that, you know, for our parenting style, we always try to put the onus on the children, the kid, to solve his own problems. You know, we don't want to be solving our kids' problems. So like you said, sure, we have some money. We could buy all the plastic junk in Toys R Us for them if we wanted to. But instead, you know, we want to put it on the child instead of asking us, hey, can I buy that? Can I buy that? Can I buy this? We want to say, okay, can you buy it? Do you have money in your wallet to spend on that money? To spend on that product, should you want it, and allowing our kids to make the mistakes to buy the plastic junk when they could have went to a garage sale and got it for a tenth of the price.
Or even, I'll say, you know, when you put the onus on your children to make those financial decisions, all of a sudden they become a lot more careful about what their decisions are going to be. Like, oh, I really want that. Can you buy that for me? Can you buy that for me? No, you have money. How about you buy it for yourself?
Oh, but I wanted to use mommy and daddy's money for it. If it's my money, I don't actually want that.
I'll pass. Exactly.
Yes. It's so empowering as a kid. But at the same time, you know, there's a story my family likes to tell where I said, well, mommy, I only want it your money's worth. I don't want it my money's worth. You know? So, yeah, it's definitely like it's empowering for the child. And in the same way that you can't learn how to walk unless you try to walk, you can't learn how to spend money unless you've had the exposure to try spending the money. And so it's really like it's a teaching moment every time they have to decide, what are they going to do with the $5? Are they going to save it for later? Are they going to spend it on this thing? It's every moment is empowering.
Right. So Megan, you know, I know we're going to dig into Roth IRAs. That's what I want to speak to you about, especially regarding kids. And a lot of people know, like, you can only fund Roth IRAs with earned income. So I want to just dive right in and talk about, you know, how kids can earn income. And I know you've written about this. So I'm curious, not just for like teenagers, you know, 16-year-olds working at McDonald's, making money. I'm talking even earlier. And we can talk about teenagers too, and just your recommendations or things you've heard other clients doing, and maybe even personal experience.
Yeah. So the internet is filled with people who will tell you that you have to have earned income to fund your Roth, and that it's, you know, probably your kid who's younger than a certain age can't do it. There's tons of those articles out there, and they're really unhelpful because they're super cagey about the whole thing and they don't really get to the point. But, you know, when you actually look at it, if you think about it without your like ageism on, it doesn't make any sense that you could have a free gardener who's, you know, you're paying them and you're not reporting that on your tax return, and they're just mowing your lawn for you. And it doesn't, like any other situation where it wasn't your child or they weren't young, you'd be like, hang on a second, someone's dodging their taxes here. And so, you know, I went looking into it to figure out, like, there's got to be an exception here that makes this not just tax evasion. Otherwise, we're all just, you know, felons. And so when you actually look into it, it turns out that that relationship is called a household employer and a household employee. And there's an entire publication that the IRS has that you can read through that's a guide for household employers. And this is the most common reason that people know about it is because they hire a nanny. Mm. And so if you hire a nanny and you're paying them a full-time salary, they could be making $60,000. And that's well over the threshold for when you don't have to report it. And it's well over the threshold for when Social Security and FICA need to get taken out. And so what happens is they pay their nanny the first year, and then it comes around to tax time and they find out, oh wait, I need to pay I need to basically pay this nanny's self-employment taxes. Mm-hmm. I need to pay their payroll taxes. And so that's how people know it. It's known as the nanny tax in like the colloquial articles. But what's cool is that parent, like written into that household employer guide is exceptions for the parent. And so the parent doesn't have to pay payroll taxes, so that Social Security and Medicare, they don't have to pay it. They don't have to do withholding unless they want to for some reason. Don't do it. It's just a headache of paperwork, you know. And so and then if your child's not making very much, if they're making less than $1,100 from any source, you don't even have to look up the rules. But if they're making more than that, you might want to look up the rules just because of unearned income. But if they're making less than that, you don't even have to file a tax return for your kid in order to fund the Roth. And so, and household employment, they have a list of types of work that a household employee might be doing. It's everything you would think of as a chore. So it's like babysitting, household cleaning, yard work. I mean, these are the things we pay our kids to do around our house all the time. And we just didn't realize that we were paying them wages as a household employee. Mm. And so the thing that I really like about the strategy of getting your child earned income and Roth funding and all of that is that it's just what you're doing anyways. You know, you don't have to go out of your way. So if you're paying them an allowance just because they're breathing, then okay, it's probably not earned income. You could maybe make an argument that it's a salary, you know, and you can try to defend it as based on your specific situation. But if they're really getting it just because they're breathing and they don't have to do any work in order to get it, okay, that's, you're just gifting them money at that point. Right. But if they have to work in order to get the money, it's a wage. Like any other working situation with any other person, it would be easily defensible as a wage. Mm-hmm. So that household employment rules are how you can get really quite young Roth funding. So my daughter, we started funding her Roth when she was 3 because we had yard work that we needed doing, and she loved picking up sticks and we needed the sticks picked up. So we paid her a penny a stick, and nice. She could just walk around the yard and pick up lots of sticks. She funded her Roth that year she started it in like October. By the end of the year, she made $1.70. We put $1.70 in her Roth. We actually matched it. So we gave her the $1.70. She got that in her pocket wallet. She could spend it or save it as she wanted. And we matched it because the same dollars don't have to go into a Roth. Mm-hmm. So we matched it by putting the $1.70 in the Roth.
Wow.
Very cool. Yeah. Our son loves to pull the weeds between the sidewalk cracks, and he loves to run around saying, "I'm a weed pulling machine."
That is awesome.
But you know, I never really considered, you know, this is just something we ask him to do at our house and at our rental properties. You know, we bring him along with us and we're like, "Here, you pull the weeds while Daddy mows the lawn." But we could be more savvy about it. Yep. The clump of weeds this high, you'll get a dollar for, or something like that.
I paid my daughter too this year to, there's blue violets that come up in the yard, and you can eat them. They're really tasty. You can put them in salads and stuff. So I paid her to go pick blue violets one day. We were going to put them in our salad for dinner.
Very cool. And you make a very interesting point there where, you know, if you hired a gardener or a landscaper or someone to do these things, you'd be paying for it, you know. Yeah. And so here it's your children helping out, but really they are doing something that is worth some kind of compensation.
Exactly.
So Megan, are there any rules for like you have to like tabulate or store somewhere like, okay, this is what they did, this is how they were paid, and this is how much they were paid to back up, you know, that this three-year-old made this money this way?
Yep. So the best defense against the IRS is always documentation. So in our household, we do a pay stub, basically, like we write it up and we put it with our taxes every year. I think the important things on it, I've got them all listed in the article, but the ones that I remember that you wouldn't just like off the top of your head think to put on are you need to write down how much was paid in cash versus how much was just paid, because you could have theoretically deposited it directly into an account somewhere. And also how much was withheld, which we always do zero. I would recommend doing zero. It's a headache not to do zero. And the date it was paid and what work was done and all of that. So just, you know, write down a little pay stub, keep it, scan it, keep it with your tax returns. It's actually pretty simple though, because it's not too much extra paperwork. Anyways, yeah, so it's pretty simple.
If you do a fund match, like you mentioned before, like they earn this amount and then you'll match it for their Roth, do you put the total of what you've paid out to the child as well as what you've deposited to the Roth, or do you just put the...
So when we match it to the Roth, we are... So I kind of think about it like two different hats. So we, when we're the household employer, we're paying them the $1.70. And then as the parent, we're like, thank you for the $1.70. I'm going to give them a gift of $1.70, which I'm going to fund their Roth with. So we only announced that she, like, she's only earned $1.70. We've gifted her $1.70 out of our own pocket. Even though, if you look at, you know, our bank account, we definitely paid her more than $1.70 because one going one way into her wallet and one going one way into the Roth. But she only earned the $1.70 like wages for the purpose of the IRS and taxes.
Okay. Yeah, I've definitely heard this technique used a lot from parents to incentivize their kids to start investing in their Roth IRA. You know, yeah, sure, go work at McDonald's for your $10 an hour job and you can spend, you know, maybe they'll do 100% match, like you were saying, with the $1.70, but you will match you whatever income you make, and we'll just put into your Roth IRA for you, and you can keep what you actually earn as spending money. But now you have earned income and you can put all of it to your Roth IRA.
Yeah. And when she's older, I think we plan on doing more of a sophisticated match where, you know, if she saves $1, we'll match her maybe $2, like way better than the average employer, but still like, you know, that kind of, you have to put a little bit in order for us to match you. But, but at this point, you know, we're still just learning like impulse control and how not to buy the Barbie that you see in front of you. And so I feel like those lessons are more valuable if she has the money in her wallet, versus, you know, teaching her savings. It's a little bit abstract at this point.
They don't quite understand the numbers, so you can't impress them with the spreadsheet of what they've saved from this month to the next month.
And when we play games, you know, where we've got, where, you know, we're buying something in the pretend game, it'll be like, how much is it for this car? Oh, it's $3. You know, it's just not quite the scale to understand.
So Megan, when you went to your financial institution and said, hey, I want to open up a Roth IRA for my three-year-old and we want to fund it with $1.70, did they laugh at you? Were they like, oh yeah, sure, let's do it?
Yeah, so I was on the phone with somebody at one point and they were saying, now how old again is your daughter? But they were trying to do it in this like chatty, you know, I have children too, how old is your daughter? And you, and you're opening a Roth IRA, is that correct? You know, so it definitely, I think it's definitely an uncommon experience for the average institution, but they didn't have any problem with it.
And from my own experience, you know, for my first two kids, that I opened them through Vanguard. But yeah, no trouble. I had to call that in. Vanguard forces you to call it in. But I just opened one up for my 9-month-old through Fidelity, and it was completely just an online process, no call in, and you could even just do a custodial Roth IRA account for your child. So
I would it's pretty easy.
Yeah, and like you said, $1.70 works. I think they recommended $10 minimum, but $1.70, I'm sure it would be fine there too.
Yep. Yeah, it's up to $9 now, but most of that is actually investment growth, because she had the experience of buying once right before the recent bear market, so like right at the top of the bear market, that was the first purchase of the $1.70. Then it crashed, you know, down to now we're at the bottom. She bought almost, I think it was like 2 days from the bottom is when we funded it again. So now she's already has under her belt what it looks like to buy at the wrong time, what it looks like to buy at the right time, and what I predict that by the time she has any care about this account, you won't be able to tell the difference between the two, which is really the, you know, true story of investing right there.
Right. Yeah. Need to get that dollar cost averaging started. Yeah. And, but I think there's so much, you know, we're kind of joking around here with small dollar amounts, but there's really serious power, like, especially once the earned income starts to become and greater thresholds, like the, I was doing like the calculation, like the stock market average growth of 7 to 8% a year, you know, over 60 years. You know, my son, when I started his Roth IRA, was zero. When he's 60 years old, you know, 59 and a half, ready to retire, how much gain that is. And it's really like 100 times growth of whatever you put in when you were zero. So like $1,000 when you're zero becomes $100,000 when you're 60 years old. So it's just an insane amount of growth. And with the Roth, you know, it's all interest or tax-free growth. So that $100,000 is not going to be taxed. It's all your money to keep 100% of it, which is so powerful.
And on top of that, you can withdraw at any point the amount that you've contributed.
Exactly.
So where, you know, you think about this like a retirement account, and you should, like long-term savings, this is definitely, this can be the retirement account. But at the same time, this could be how they fund their first business. This could be how they fund their first house, because you can withdraw up to the amount you've contributed. And if you've contributed for that long, especially you guys maxing it almost, you know, like that's going to be a huge dollar amount that you can withdraw.
Yeah, for sure. And I love what you said about the contribution basis. Whatever you put in, you can withdraw at any point, which is so powerful. Too.
So powerful.
And I think a lot of people don't know that. So there's a lot of fear around locking up your money in some kind of future savings account without understanding the flexibility that's actually there for you should you need it.
Yeah, the Roth is so powerful. Almost any problem you have can probably be solved in some way by a Roth IRA.
So I want to talk to you a little bit, just because you deal with this space, about, you know, 529s, because I know a lot of times, you know, when people think just college savings, they purely think 529. They don't even consider the Roth IRA because that's retirement. But I want to talk to you about that. Let's just dive into that. So let's talk about the 529 and your thoughts on, you know, pitting that against the Roth IRA.
I mean, I think they're both wonderful. Roth IRAs are the college savings account from before 529s ever existed. Clearly a great choice. I think you can use a Roth IRA there. The 529 has a few advantages, mainly that you can get, for most states, you can get a state tax deduction when you put it in. And so so here in Virginia, you can get, it's a per account state tax deduction in Virginia, but you can open as many accounts as you want. So just a huge state tax deduction, basically. And then, so because of that, you know, you get extra savings. It's both tax-free if you're using it for education, and then, you know, you get the state tax deduction. So that can really add some extra value there. Also, it's not just for college anymore. So if you have any sort of elementary school tuition or secondary school tuition, really recently, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, now you can get $10,000 per year reimbursed as a qualified education expense. So for most people, that's about maybe half of the tuition that they're paying if it's a nice private school. But still, it means that you could just open an account. It can sit empty 99% of the year. You fund it with the amount you would like to pay for the tuition, you immediately withdraw it, and now you got a state tax deduction. So for a little bit of paperwork, you can get a write-off on your state taxes. And now you can also, it's a lifetime limit, but you can reimburse up to $10,000 in student loans now as a qualified expense too. So it's kind of like a one-time thing for a lot of people, because again, it's like a lifetime limit. But if there's any extra leftover or whatever, you can use it there. And then actually, I just withdrew from my 529 like recently, because most like credentials and trade schools and things like that now qualify as additional qualified education expenses. So I recently got a financial credential. I was able to pay the tuition costs out of the 529.
Wow, amazing.
So there's a lot more options than most people think.
Okay. And then in terms, I know you have an article about like who should open a 529. What would you like to say about that?
Yeah, so it really only matters who should open the 529 if you're thinking about filling out the FAFSA. So if you're thinking about trying to get help paying for college, then it's...
What is the FAFSA, real quick?
Yeah, so it's the federal student aid form that you can fill out to apply for grant money and subsidized loans and things like that. It's like the one form that gets you all of the, you know, extra help from the government to pay for college. So they change their rules pretty regularly. So, you know, if you have a four-year-old today, there's no way of really knowing what the rules of the FAFSA are going to be when it's your turn to apply for it. But at the same time, grandparent-owned accounts have never been even considered being on the FAFSA. And so a grandparent-owned 529 is a nice way of just getting it off of the FAFSA. There's a little bit of a workaround in the present day that you can do to ensure that distributions from the account also don't count against you on the FAFSA, but it's a workaround that you wouldn't be able to have if the student owned it, or if even like you as the parent owned it. So there's a small case for that grandparent owned FAFSA. Also the fact that it's hard to get your own parents involved, like the grandparents involved later on in the process. So if you're like, they're 18 right now and I'd like you to open a 529 so I can roll my funds into it so that I can apply on the FAFSA, it's like a weird conversation to have. But if you're like, hey, my four-year-old, we're thinking about saving for college, and I read this article or I heard this podcast where they talked about how it would be really great if grandparents owned it, there's a lot of buy-in there, because like the grandparents already want to lavish their grandchildren normally. And so if they have the extra finances or they're already looking for a way to give, they're just going to be so excited to be involved in the process. And so it's another reason why a grandparent owned 529 can be a great move, because it opens up your options when it finally comes time to go to college.
A quick question on that, considering, you know, the reality of the age disparity, and your grandparents perhaps open the account when your child is four. You know, what if your grandparents are not still with you when your child is finally 20 and looking to actually perhaps look into FAFSA or college and so forth? Does the account transfer into the child's name and then therefore becomes their own, or how does that work?
So 529s are sometimes called a poor man's trust, because you get to name a new successor owner and they can have nothing to do with the beneficiary at all. So you can name, so, you know, let's say like your own mother owns the account, and then she's named dad as the successor owner. And then when he takes out control, he could name his brother. Like, he could name somebody totally random. He could name one of you, anybody. And so it's considered a poor man's trust in that way, because it just, the assets are always for the benefit of this beneficiary, but then it can kind of move around whoever's the like trustee. Also, it's not locked into that one beneficiary. So let's say that you only had one kid, and when, you know, your parents were alive and they fund this huge 529, it's excessively large. But then you have three kids now, and, you know, why does that one kid have all of the money? Well, you're able to roll over who the beneficiary is, basically like into nuclear family relationships or even spouse relationships. You're able to split it, roll it over. So you can kind of divvy up the pot when it finally comes time to figure out like who needs the money where. So for example, I had a 529 when I married my husband. I actually graduated a year early, and we got married before he had finished college. And so I was able to roll over some of my 529 funds into his name. Wow. And then we paid for his last year of college out of that. And so, you know, it's really flexible what a 529 can do because of all of that. You know, you can change the beneficiary, you can change the owner. Like, it's really just education savings, really generic.
Can a grandparent who has 20 grandkids divvy up their 529 to, and like 10 of the grandkids are in college at that 1 year, can she just pay for the colleges for all 10 kids at the same time?
Well, so you'll need to have the assets actually in an account named for that beneficiary okay. at the time when you're incurring the education expense. Or at least okay. that's like the best practice. There's a lot of like Wild West in 529s, which is a little uncomfortable, I feel like, for both the IRS and like us people trying to use it. So like, is that a hard and fast rule? I don't know if I could find that hard and fast rule, but it's a really good best practice. So it's good to have the assets already in the 529 when you're incurring the expense. So, but on the other hand, yeah, you can have a grandparent who owns a big 529 and they're just rolling out the funds. So long as you have the living nuclear family to draw the line from the old beneficiary to the new one, you can make the rollover. There's the small chance that you can get hit with a generation skipping transfer tax if you're moving it too far across the tree. So it's better like to have it, you know, at rest in the spot you think you're going to use it. So you may as well. Also here in Virginia, again, like in order to get the full deduction, you need to open more than one account. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of grandparents will have 20 accounts open, but they're only funding it for two grandchildren. So it's just because it's like, I wanted to save more than that this year. So anyways, yeah, it's.
So it's here's possible, a question. Especially, I thought it was very interesting what you said in that you can use a 529 for other educational expenses beyond college, such as secondary or elementary school, private school education. How about for the families who choose to homeschool? Are they able to use those funds towards educational resources like their curriculum purchases for the year and whatever they might be buying in terms of school supplies for their kids? Because I know a lot of homeschool families do incur a lot of expenses, and especially nowadays, a lot of parents are starting to homeschool. And it is an expense that I think comes unexpected if you're coming out of a public school situation and now all of a sudden you're trying to do it privately on your own. Can you use those funds towards those kind of academic expenses?
So as written now, the only expense you can use for elementary and secondary school is tuition. Mm-hmm. So just starting there, if you don't have tuition, you don't fit into the right bucket to charge the expense as a qualified one. There is the exception, though, that some states, so the definition of a school is a state-by-state thing, and some states count homeschooling as a private school. So you'd have to look up your specific state. Here in Virginia, it's not. It's a separate thing. Mm-hmm. But there's homeschooling, and then there's private school, and then there's public school. But right. in some states, there's private school, and there's public school, and that's the only divide that they have. And if mm-hmm. that's the case, and you had some sort of homeschooling co-op that you were going to, the tuition of that co-op would count as tuition, potentially, mm-hmm. if they've structured it all right.
Interesting.
Also, if you have a special needs child, actually, basically every expense you incur counts, regardless of tuition, is my memory of it. I'd go look it up before you actually, you know, go start expensing stuff, what the real list is. But my memory is that if you have a special needs child, there's a lot more that counts as a qualified expense all the way through life.
Wow. So it's state by state, depending on where you live, the different regulations for the mm-hmm. 529.
Yeah. But you wouldn't be able to expense in any circumstances like the cost of books or curriculum, which mm-hmm. is kind of annoying because it's just that tuition.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the version that passed the House included homeschooling as one of the qualified expenses, had a huge paragraph of all the expenses that you could have. And the Senate took it out. So it's almost there. It was also in an earlier version of a bill. They had the homeschooling things in there in a way earlier bill that got killed. So there's the mumbling that homeschooling might become a qualified expense, but so far it's been shut down.
Yeah, right. I feel like especially with the recent COVID events, that's probably becoming right. more and more popular, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Megan, you know, I think we explored the 529 pretty well and the Roth IRA pretty well, but I'm curious, you know, you're such an expert on all things money. I'm curious to know, you know, stepping away from children, but like parents like own investments and their fear of, you know, current events. We're talking right now, October 26th, we're like 8 days or 7 days away from Election Day. And there's a lot of fears on COVID, presidential results, riots. What is your general recommendation on you know, pulling to safer investment classes or changing allocations and that kind of thing. Yeah,
there certainly is a lot of fear these days. The thing that I always, the analogy I always like to use for the stock market is, imagine that there's a person and they're holding a whip and they're cracking it back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And if you're following the end of the tip, that's the current price in the stock market. And it's just moving all around. It's really crazy. Sometimes he cracks it so low, you never thought he could crack it that low. And then another time he's cracking it so high, you didn't think he could reach that high. But the stock market trends upward. So this guy who's cracking the whip, he's on an escalator. So like eventually he can't crack it as low as he could before because he's just moved up higher and higher, and he can suddenly crack it higher than he could before. And so when you take a long-term perspective, you only see the escalator. Mm-hmm. You're just like, wow, this is really trending upward. There's a lot to be gained here. I could go to a whole new level. But when you're following the tip of the whip, it's really scary what's going to happen. You know, it went from so high to so low. How did it do that? And so taking the long-term perspective in any scenario is a great move. So if you're really afraid about the current events, ask yourself, when am I going to use this money? You know, is this money for tomorrow? If it's for tomorrow, don't put it in the stocks. It's not the right spot for it because that tip of the whip could really upset you. Right. But if you're going to spend it in 11 years, 20 years, you're on the escalator. Like, it's going to be fine. You know, in the long run, what happens after these elections is not going to ruin the plan. And in fact, what will ruin the plan is if you do what we call a flatlining. So if you take everything out of the market and you sit on the sidelines in cash, on average, that's going to be a terrible move because now you've bet your entire savings on whether you can pick the right day to get back in. And like, I'm not going to take that gamble. I'm a professional. I'm not taking that gamble. There's no way I'm going to take that gamble because what am I going to do? I'm going to sit around and wait until I feel better. When am I going to feel better about it? I'm going to feel better about it at the point when it was where I took it out. Well, if I'm just going to sit and wait for it to get back to where it was, I may as well have just ridden it down and back up again. There's no, what if I missed the right day? What if I'm a day late? Now I sold and then I bought when it was higher. This is really dumb advice here. Like, no, you're supposed to buy when it's low. So it's way better to just hold it out. Now, that being said, you do need an asset allocation that's actually built, assuming that the market will go down. It will go down. It's going to go down at some point. Who knows when? Nobody. But it's going to go down at some point. And when it does go down, you should have a plan that was ready for it, that thought it was going to go down. So don't have a highly concentrated portfolio. Diversification is one way that you protect yourselves against bear markets and crashes and depressions and all sorts of other things that can happen in the stock market. And on top of that, you know, if you do need the money within the next 10 years, 7 years, 5 years, if you do need the money in that shorter term range, then like bonds is a great spot to put that. It's a good spot to put that regardless of what the market is doing, because if you withdraw from a stock portfolio and you happen to withdraw on a down, you actually can mess up your portfolio. Whereas if you have those bonds there to balance it out, your stocks are going around, they're doing what they're doing, but you know you're not going to have to withdraw from your stocks on a down because you've got those bonds there to withdraw from. So you don't add bonds to a portfolio to boost returns. You just add it to support a withdrawal rate. So if you know you're going to withdraw, get those bonds in there so that you can protect yourself against it.
Wow, great advice. I love that analogy, by the way. I never heard that, and I thought that was a great one.
Thanks.
Megan, so just curious, you know, you've done this for a long time and you've spoken to a lot of clients. I'm wondering if you have any kind of golden nuggets or just words of wisdom you like to talk to every young family just starting out, young couple just starting out, in terms of just trying to grow their wealth.
Well, I think the most important thing is what your own goals are in life and that you shouldn't lose sight of what your financial goals are. So there's a story I really like. It's from the Crazy Rich Asians book series. So it's not in the movie, but in the books, there's this scene where the wealthiest woman in Singapore, okay, she's shopping at the grocery store. And at the same time, she gets a phone call from her cousin Her cousin is representing her at an art auction. He's asking if she wants to bid $100 million on a piece of artwork. Okay, so she's in the grocery store and she's being asked, does she want to spend $100 million? It's a crazy bid and he doesn't think she should do it, but she never set a limit with him. And she's saying, oh, maybe I should do it. And she's making this decision. At the same time that she's making this decision, she's handing the store clerk Super Saver coupons to pay for her frozen peas. And this is the image of financial freedom and what it looks like to be wealthy right there. You're miserly in the areas of your life that you don't care about. Like mm-hmm. she does not care about her groceries. She's going to pay those Super Saver coupons to get her peas on sale. But at the same time, in the areas of her life that are really important to her, which is this beautiful artwork that she's trying to purchase, she's lavish. You know, she's living her life with the freedom that she wants to live her life with. Mm. And so I think when you're trying to dream about what your finances are like and you're trying to dream about how you're going to get to your goals, you need to figure out what's the core, what's the thing that you love that you really just don't want to make cuts in it.
Right.
You know, so for me and my family, we don't make cuts in our food budget. We love our food budget. I like eating really good food. I don't want to have to, you know, I don't want to have to meal plan around what's on sale. I want to eat the meal that I want to eat and I want to cook the thing that I want to cook. I'm not going to make cuts there, right. You know, but there's other areas of our life that I don't really like spending money there. You know, I'm not a fashion person. I don't love spending money on clothes. I don't really have the taste for it. I basically have a budget close to $0 so that I just don't have to think about that. And mm-hmm. I'm miserly and I redirect my money towards my food budget. And so I think it's a great exercise to just sit down and think about what are all the things that you're spending money on and then figure out, you know, if you had to stop spending money on one of these, what's the next one that you would stop and you'd have a great life even though you stopped it? Mm-hmm. And then just make cuts, slash it up, figure out how little you can spend in that area. And suddenly you're going to be so much closer to that dream life where you're buying $100 million painting in the grocery store.
I love that. And, you know, it's a very humorous and a very exaggerated example. I think it drives home a really important concept there, which is that financial freedom, wealth, and success doesn't necessarily mean that money is flying out of your pockets and that you can just spend it, you know, aimlessly on absolutely anything. But that, you know, it's a disciplined lifestyle in which you've deeply thought out all the areas of your life where you think there is worth in spending and where you think you can be disciplined enough to pull back, have self-control, save, and be frugal in those areas. And just that fine balance of figuring out, you know, well, I have money, but what am I going to do with it? And that wraps right back to that point you made at the very beginning of the show, which was training your kids from a young age the ability to make those decisions. Well, I have this money. I have this $5 in my pocket. Am I going to just spend it on the first thing that comes along, or am I going to spend it on something that truly has worth and value in my life and that I'm going to be happy with that decision in the long run? You know, is it going to give me long-term contentment or happiness, or is it just a spur-of-the-moment thing and then away went my money and away went my happiness and I'm fraught with more fear for how I'm going to pay for tomorrow's meal? So I think that that was an excellent analogy there about the peas in the supermarket and the painting on the telephone. I really do love that. And I feel like it's something that not a lot of people think about. They think that wealth and financial freedom equals wealth also equals just spending money on whatsoever. When in fact, it's just about, you know, living within your means, understanding how to spend responsibly, and finding that fine balance and how you can create it on any budget that you are working with. You know, it doesn't matter whether you make a minimum wage job or you're a CEO and making, you know, a higher wage job. If you can figure out how to live within your means and how to spend responsibly, you can reach that place of financial security.
It's so true. Yep. Wealth is what you save, not what you spend. So if you're spending it, it's not wealth anymore.
Right. Yep.
So Megan, talking about books, what's one of your favorite books?
One of my favorite books. I do. I really like right now. I don't know about favorite books, but right now I'm reading a Disney Fairies series with my daughter. And it is just so delightful and enjoyable that it's really the only thing that's coming to mind. We've got like 24 Disney Fairies comic books and something like 20 different books that we've chapter books. And they're just so delightful. It's pretty much the best thing I've been reading to my daughter.
What is the latest title of one of those books?
The Trouble with Tink, which is Tinkerbell.
Okay. We'll have to check that out.
I can relate. My son's listening to the Boxcar Children series, and the other day I was in the car, and Aunt Sunny's like, oh, you want to turn this off and listen to one of our audiobooks, nonfiction? I'm like, no, I'm really into this mystery, the mystery of Peacock Hall. What's going to happen?
That's so true. Yes. And they're really wonderful. If you have it, I don't know if your kids are in the early stages of reading to themselves, but the comic book ones are easy enough that my daughter can read them to herself.
Oh,
and
nice.
Now and again, there's a word that gets stuck on, but because of the pictures, and you know, she can read through it, and so it's really enjoyable. Sometimes she reads it to me, and sometimes I read it to her.
That's how awesome. Sweet.
I didn't even know Disney had a comic book series.
Yeah. Have you seen the Tinkerbell movie series?
No, actually,
I
we haven't.
Know.
We have boys, older boys.
It's true. They're so delightful. I wish that they were around when I was a kid. If they were, it would have been my favorite movie. I think as an adult, it's in the top favorite movies still. I really like them.
Okay, that's a strong recommendation. And in terms of hobbies, what do you like to do, Megan?
Yeah, I really like, I like art. So I don't do anything like super big or amazing, but I at this point I do coloring with my daughter, you know, but I'll do like expert shading because that's, you know, just my mind entertained. And I also collect board games. So
oh, cool.
I have a lot of board games and I love playing them. One of my favorite ones I got recently is Disney Villainous. I know I sound like I'm a Disney fan. I am a Disney fan, but I sound a little bit more like it than I may have intended. I also really like, there's a Czech game series I really like. One of them is Dungeon Pets. And Forbidden Island is a really great family game. Anyways.
I bought that for him for his birthday.
We have yet to play it.
Yes.
And we have a new guest entering the podcast. Valen, you want to say hello? Yeah. Anyway,
hello.
Just wrapping up here, Megan. You know, I feel like so many times, you know, we kind of get focused in on, you know, our day-to-day activities, but I feel like so much of what we do, you know, has a greater purpose. And I just want to ask you, like, how do you change the world, Megan?
How do I change the world?
How do you change
the
world?
I do think that my articles are a really big way that I help change the world. I'm all about accuracy and clarity and just kind of getting to the heart of what the real advice is there. And there's not a ton of people in the financial writing world that I think have that goal. There's a lot of just kind of, maybe you could do one of these things. And so I really like giving the clarity to empower people who are doing it themselves. And I love the fact that we're a financial planning firm, so we do have clients. That's how we make our money. But I love the fact that we have the big enough heart that we just hope that we can empower tons of people who never pay us. You know, we want to be the partner to anybody who needs a partner for getting financial planning and advice in that way. And so I really think those articles are the big way that I'm changing the world today.
Yeah, no, I really love your articles. I was reading your article about how a dryer works or the cost of your dryer, and it's like it's like a book, it's a novel, and you go so in depth. But I love to see all your articles have all this real in-depth real world application. Like you were mentioning, so many articles online that just like so generic and just like, why did I just spend 50 words reading? It didn't tell me anything.
Right.
But I think that your articles are so awesome, and that's really why I wanted to reach out and have you on the show. I'm so glad we did. I'd like to speak more, like, what is your business, and is it a family business, and what is the objective, and what can people gain by checking you guys out?
Yeah, so I work for Murata Wealth Management, which it's both a family business and it's just a large financial planning firm. So my father and I and I guess my mother are the like the family portion, but we've got you know, close to 15 employees, and so we're a big wealth management firm. We think of ourselves as the holistic planner of finance, and so just like you need your primary care doctor to just know everything about you and be able to know when you should get referred to somebody else and be able to do basically almost anything, you know, to care for your health, we think of ourselves that way. So we provide a real big comprehensive holistic service. We offer things like we'll do a tax plan for our clients, which projects them from whatever age they are now all the way through age 100. We'll just try to model their financial life, and then we'll try to see what happens if we manage your capital gains this way. Does it provide more value? What if we do Roth conversion strategies this way? Does it provide more value to develop like a full tax plan for them? So we go really in depth. We do tons of things there.
That's awesome.
But, we can't do that for everybody because it's just so much work. And so we have a service level that we call do it yourself, which is our, we empower you with our financial planning articles, but we help you do the investing part. And so it has no minimums and it has a really small fee. And we just take the investing off of your hands so that you don't have to worry about what's the market doing and am I invested for the right, you know, in the right way. You don't have to worry. You have a partner for when you have election fears, you know, and you have a partner for when you're tempted to flatline. We're there to say, don't do it. You know, and if we can say, don't do it without you signing up as a client and that helps you, awesome. So wonderful. But if you want to partner in it, we've got that. We have that service level. So our clients span the whole range for that reason. You know, we've got the people with just a little bit of money in their Roth, and we've got the clients that are high net worth individuals.
Awesome. Awesome. So I had a question recently brought to me by a friend, a coworker, actually. He's older, you know, in his 50s, he's getting ready to retire. He has a paid off house. He's been funding his 401k, you know, forever. And his mom actually just recently died and left him a $600,000 inheritance. What would you advise he do?
Well, anytime you get a windfall, the best advice is to save at least 97% of it, because a 3% withdrawal rate is how you can make a perpetual portfolio, theoretically, if you're investing it. And so if you save 97%, you won't accidentally make your lifestyle so big that you run out of money, because windfalls sometimes make you run out of money. Mm. So I would, that would be my, like, right out of the gate, that's the first advice.
That was a good answer. Better advice than I could give him. I was like, I don't know. Give me it.
Yeah. Yeah. The danger with getting a windfall is that you think, well, I have all this money, so I could do more things. And so then you relax in a higher lifestyle. But what you don't realize is that if you draw down those assets too fast, you can inflate your standard of living such that you're actually now running out of money, even though you just got more money.
Right.
So that's how the lottery winners go bankrupt. They're like, oh, well, I want $1 million. I could spend half of it today. But you get used to spending half of it today. And if you spend half of it today and you spend half of it a year from today, you don't have any more. So, yeah, definitely the saving would be the most important step.
Wow, great answer to a random question. So thank you, Megan.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's been a real pleasure chatting with you. If people want to talk to you, is there a way that they can reach out to you? Maybe just talk to the company. How can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, so our website is maradaonmoney.com. So Marotta is MARROTTA on money.com. And we have a free newsletter that you can subscribe, and every week you get an email of whatever our latest articles are. And if you want to contact us, there's a contact us form there, and it has all the information both about our services, but also we don't have any secrets here at Marotta. We just love giving it away for free. So if you read enough of our articles, you could learn how to do everything that we're doing. And if you want to do that and you have the time to do that, you should do it, because there's a lot of really great value that we can add, and there's a lot of great value that we could teach you to add to yourself.
Awesome. Awesome.
I love that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It's really been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will have learned a lot as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan.